Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Postmodernism, A Very Short Introduction by Christopher Butler. Narrated by Christine Williams.
Chapter 1. The Rise of Postmodernism. Carl André's rectangular pile of bricks, equivalent 8, from 1966, annoyed lots of people when shown at the Tate Gallery, London, in 1976. It is a typically postmodernist object. Now re-enshrined in the Tate Modern, it doesn't resemble much in the canon of modernist sculpture. It is not formally complex or expressive, or particularly engaging to look at. Indeed, it can soon be boring. It is easy to repeat, lacking any features to sustain interest in itself, except perhaps to Pythagorean number mystics. It inspires us to ask questions about its context rather than its content. What is the point of this? Or, why is this displayed in a museum? Some theory about the work has to be brought in to fill the vacuum of interest, and this is also fairly typical. It might inspire the question, is it really art, or just a heap of bricks pretending to be art? But this is not a question that makes much sense in the postmodernist era, in which it seems to be generally accepted that it is the institution of the gallery, rather than anything else, which has made it, de facto, a work of art. The visual arts just are what museum curators show us, from Picasso to sliced-up cows, and it is up to us to keep up with the ideas surrounding these works. Many postmodernists, and of course their museum director allies, would like us to entertain such thoughts about the ideas which might surround this minimalist art. A pile of bricks is designedly elementary. It confronts and denies the emotionally expressive qualities of previous modernist art. Like Duchamp's famous urinal, or his bicycle wheel mounted on a stool, it tests our intellectual responses and our tolerance of the works that the art gallery can bring to the attention of its public. It makes some essentially critical points, which add up to some quite self-denying assumptions about art. André says, "What I try to find are sets of particles and the rules which combine them in the simplest way," and claims that his equivalents are communistic because the form is equally accessible to all men. This sculpture, however politically correct it may be interpreted to be, isn't nearly as enjoyable as Rodin's Kiss, or the far more intricate abstract structures of a sculptor like Anthony Caro. André's theoretical avant-gardism, which tests our intellectual responses, suggests that the pleasures taken in earlier art are a bit suspect. Puritanism, calling into question, and making an audience feel guilty or disturbed are all intimately linked by objects like this. They are attitudes which are typical of much postmodernist art, and they often have a political dimension. The artwork for which Martin Creed won the Turner Prize in 2001 continues this tradition. It is an empty room in which the electric lights go on and off. I will be writing about postmodern artists, intellectual gurus, academic critics, philosophers, and social scientists in what follows, as if they were all members of a loosely constituted and quarrelsome political party. This party is by and large internationalist and progressive. It is on the left rather than the right, and it tends to see everything, from abstract painting to personal relationships, as political undertakings. It is not particularly unified in doctrine, and even those who have most significantly contributed ideas to its manifestos sometimes indignantly deny membership. And yet the postmodernist party tends to believe that its time has come. It is certain of its uncertainty, and often claims that it has seen through the sustaining illusions of others, and so has grasped the real nature of the cultural and political institutions which surround us. In doing this, postmodernists often follow Marx. They claim to be peculiarly aware of the unique state of contemporary society, immured as it is in what they call the postmodern condition. Postmodernists, therefore, do not simply support aesthetic isms or avant-garde movements such as minimalism or conceptualism, from which work like André's bricks emerged. They have a distinct way of seeing the world as a whole, and use a set of philosophical ideas that not only support an aesthetic, but also analyze a late capitalist cultural condition of postmodernity. This condition is supposed to affect us all, not just through avant-garde art, but also at a more fundamental level, through the influence of that huge growth in media communication by electronic means, which Marshall McLuhan in the 1960s called the electronic village. And yet, in our new information society, paradoxically enough, most information is apparently to be distrusted, as being more of a contribution to the manipulative image-making of those in power than to the advancement of knowledge. The postmodernist attitude is therefore one of a suspicion which can border on paranoia, as seen, for example, in the conspiracy theory novels of Thomas Pynchon and Don DeLillo and the films of Oliver Stone. A major Marxist commentator on postmodernism, Frederick Jameson, sees John Portman's Westin Bonaventura Hotel in Los Angeles as entirely symptomatic of this condition. Its extraordinary complexities of entranceways, its aspiration towards being a complete world, a kind of miniature city, and its perpetually moving elevators make it a mutation into a postmodernist hyperspace, which transcends the capacities of the human body to locate itself, to find its own position in a mappable world. This milling confusion, says Jameson, is a dilemma, a symbol and analog of the incapacity of our minds to map the great global, multinational, and decentered communicational network in which we find ourselves caught as individual subjects. Many of us have felt something like this in London's Barbican Centre. This lost-in-a-big-hotel view of our condition shows postmodernism to be a doctrine for the metropolis, within which a new climate of ideas has arisen and brought with it a new sensibility. But these ideas and attitudes have always been very much open to debate, and in what follows, I shall combat postmodernist skepticism with some of my own. Indeed, I will deny that its philosophical and political views and art forms are nearly as dominant as a confident proclamation of a new postmodernist era might suggest. It is nevertheless obvious by now that even if we restrict ourselves to the ideas current within the artistic avant-garde since 1945, we can sense a break with those of the modernist period. The work of James Joyce is very different from that of Alain Robbe-Grillet, that of Igor Stravinsky from that of Karlheinz Stockhausen, that of Henri Matisse from that of Robert Rauschenberg, of Jean Renoir from that of Jean-Luc Godard, of Jacob Epstein from that of Carl André, and of Mies van der Rohe from that of Robert Venturi. What one makes of this contrast between the modern and the postmodern in the arts largely depends on the values one embraces. There is no single line of development to be found here. Many of these differences arose from the sensitivity of artists to changes in the climate of ideas. By the mid-1960s, critics like Susan Sontag and Ihab Hassan had begun to point out some of the characteristics, in Europe and in the United States, of what we now call postmodernism. They argued that the work of postmodernists was deliberately less unified, less obviously masterful, more playful or anarchic, more concerned with the processes of our understanding than with the pleasures of artistic finish or unity, less inclined to hold a narrative together, and certainly more resistant to a certain interpretation than much of the art that had preceded it. We will look at some examples of this later on. The rise of theory. Somewhat later than the period in which the artists mentioned above established themselves, a further postmodernist development took place, the rise of theory among intellectuals and academics. Workers in all sorts of fields developed an excessively critical self-consciousness. Postmodernists reproached modernists and their supposedly naive liberal humanist readers or spectators or listeners for their belief that a work of art could somehow appeal to all humanity and so be free of divisive political implications. The rise of the great post-war innovatory artists, Stockhausen, Boulez, Robbe-Grillet, Beckett, Coover, Rauschenberg, and Beuys, was succeeded, and many would say supplemented and explained, by the huge growth in the influence of a number of French intellectuals, notably the Marxist social theorist Louis Althusser, the cultural critic Roland Barthes, the philosopher Jacques Derrida, and the historian Michel Foucault, all of whom, in fact, began their work by thinking about the implications of modernism, and rarely had any very extended relationship to the contemporary avant-garde. Althusser was concerned with Brecht, Barthes with Flaubert and Proust, Derrida with Nietzsche, Heidegger, and Mallarmé, and Foucault with Nietzsche and Bataille. By the mid-1970s, it becomes difficult to know what matters most to postmodernists: the fashioning of a particular kind of disturbing experience within art, or the new philosophical and political interpretive opportunities which it offered. Many would now say that for committed postmodernists, interpretive implications were always and disastrously privileged over the enjoyable artistic embodiment and formal sophistication which so many had learned to appreciate in modernist art. This startlingly new framework of ideas was exported from the France of the late 1960s and early 1970s into England, Germany, and the United States. By the time of the student uprisings of 1968, the most advanced philosophical thought had moved away from the strongly ethical and individualist existentialism that was typical of the immediately post-war period, of which Sartre and Camus were the best publicized exponents, towards far more skeptical and anti-humanist attitudes. These new beliefs were expressed in what came to be known as deconstructive and post-structuralist theory, to be discussed later. The new novelists in France also moved away from an interest in the philosophico-emotional states of angst and absurdity, and a commitment to the mimetic engagements of a traditionally narrated novel, such as Sartre's La Nausée or Camus' La Peste and L'Étranger, towards a far colder, contradiction-filled anti-narrative method in the texts of Alain Robbe-Grillet, Philippe Solers, and others, who were not so much interested in individual character or coherent narrative suspense and interest as in the play of their own authorial language. The new ideas, although they came to inspire some literature and to dominate its interpretation in academic circles, were actually rooted outside the arts. Barthes was mainly interested in the application of linguistic models to the interpretation of text. Derrida's philosophical work began as a critique of linguistics, and Foucault's base was in the social sciences and history. They were also all guided to a greater or lesser degree by the rereading or redemption of Marx, whose dominance in places like the Soviet Union was, before 1989, rather airily explained away as due to a misapplied bureaucratic socialism. Most of the French intellectuals responsible for the theoretical inspiration of postmodernism worked within a broadly Marxist paradigm. Postmodernist doctrines thus drew upon a great deal of philosophical, political, and sociological thought, which disseminated itself into the artistic avant-garde, particularly in the visual arts, and into the humanities departments of universities in Europe and the United States as theory. The postmodernist period is one of the extraordinary dominance of the work of academics over that of artists. This was not theory as it might be understood in the philosophy of science, in which theories are tested and so verifiable or falsifiable, or in the Anglo-American, broadly empiricist philosophy. It was a far more self-involved, skeptical type of discourse, which adapted general concepts derived from traditional philosophy to literary, sociological, or other material, which was thereby given a postmodernist twist. Lost in translation? Many academic proponents of postmodernist theory in England and the United States therefore concentrated on the inward translation of continental thought. This led to a number of interestingly transplanted cultural concerns and a sharp break with previous traditions. For example, postmodernist theory inherited a concern for the functions of language from structuralism. But when Jacques Derrida turned his attention to the problem of reference, of language to external non-linguistic reality, he went back to the linguist Ferdinand de Saussure. Derrida struggled with him in De la Grammatologie, apparently in blissful ignorance of the fact that many of the problems which concerned him, and the very slippery position he himself came to, had, in the opinion of many in the philosophical community, even in France, been far better stated and more rigorously analyzed by Ludwig Wittgenstein. But Derrida does not mention Wittgenstein in his early work. Many Derridian literary theorists were therefore seriously ignorant of the history of philosophical problems, and were unaware of some of the standard solutions to them in the Anglo-American philosophical tradition. This led to intellectual division, mutual incomprehension, and splits in many university departments that persist to this day. Postmodernists, who were rightly enthusiasts for liberating ethical and political doctrines, were at the same time immensely dependent on the extraordinary prestige of these new intellectual authorities, whose influence was not a little sustained by their heavy reliance upon a neologizing jargon, which imparted a tremendous air of difficulty and profundity to their deliberations and caused great difficulties to their translators. According to the American philosopher John Searle, from the New York Review of Books on October 27, 1983, Michel Foucault once characterized Derrida's prose style to me as obscurantisme terroriste. The text is written so obscurely that you can't figure out exactly what the thesis is, hence obscurantisme. And when one criticizes this, the author says, vous m'avez mal compris, vous êtes idiot, hence terroriste. The often obscure, not to say obfuscating, modes of speech and writing of these intellectuals were sometimes even intended to signify a defiance of that Cartesian clarity of exposition, which they said arose from a suspect reliance upon bourgeois certainties concerning the world order. Roland Barthes, discussing 17th-century French literature in Œuvre complète, Volume 1, from 1942 through 1965, says that doubtless there was a certain universality of writing which stretched across to the elite elements of Europe living the same privileged lifestyle. But this much-prized communicability of the French language has been anything but horizontal. It has never been vertical, never reached the depths of the masses. A suggestive punning wordplay was preferred to a plodding and politically suspect logic, and the result was a theory which was more literary than philosophical, and which rarely, if ever, came to clear or empirically testable conclusions, simply because it was so difficult to be sure about what it meant. This placed a very satisfying burden of translation, exposition, and defense upon the followers of the masters of theory. The French masters wrote in a resolutely avant-gardist way against the clarity of their own national tradition. It is the thousands of echoes and adaptations, and unsurprising misunderstandings, of their obscure writings that have made up the often confused and pretentious collective psyche of the postmodernist constituency. Here is an example of a far from untypical sentence, which won the second prize in the annual Bad Writing Contest promoted by the scholarly journal Philosophy and Literature. It may or may not become clearer to the reader by the end of this book, and it comes from Homi Bhabha's much referred to The Location of Culture from 1994. If, for a while, the ruse of desire is calculable for the uses of discipline, soon the repetition of guilt, justification, pseudoscientific theories, superstition, spurious authorities, and classification can be seen as the desperate effort to normalize normally the disturbance of a discourse of splitting that violates the rational, enlightened claims of its enunciatory modality. There is, therefore, a great contrast and tension between the postmodernism which derived from French intellectuals and the mainstream of Anglo-American liberal philosophical thought in this period. The latter tradition had been very suspicious, in a post-Orwellian manner, of jargon, of grandiose synthesis, and of Marxist-derived ideology. In the 1960s and early 1970s, it was much wedded to very different methods, and most particularly to the idea that philosophy should work within an ordinary language accessible to all, and even when technical, aim at maximum clarity. The typical work of philosophy in English, from Gilbert Ryle's The Concept of Mind from 1949 through to John Rawls's A Theory of Justice from 1971, used these methods to ask for an essentially cooperative and consensual method, and for further clarification and piecemeal correction by the philosophy profession as a whole, to which indeed the original authority might well respond, as did Rawls in his later Political Liberalism from 1993. In this, it was as much influenced by the model of scientific cooperation as by Socratic methods. But postmodernist ideas, despite their Marxist affiliations and political aspirations, were never intended to fit into anything like this kind of consensual and cooperative framework. Many postmodernists thought that this would have simply reproduced a bourgeois view of the world and aimed at an unjustifiable universal acceptance. There is a sense in which French postmodernism is a true successor to the Surrealist movement, which also tried to disrupt supposedly normal ways of seeing things. The danger, but also the point for many postmodernists, of embedding theoretical and philosophical arguments within a literary rhetoric is that the text is thereby left open to all sorts of interpretations. There is, as we shall see, a deep irrationalism at the heart of postmodernism, a kind of despair about the Enlightenment-derived public functions of reason, which is not to be found elsewhere in the other developing intellectual disciplines of the late 20th century, for example, in the influence of cognitive science on linguistics, or the use of Darwinian models to explain mental development. Books of a postmodernist persuasion are often advertised by their publishers not for their challenging hypotheses or arguments, but for their use of theory, their insights, their interventions, their addressing rather than answering questions. Some broad distinctions between the philosophy and ethics, the aesthetics, and the political sociology of postmodernism structure the account which follows. In all three areas, the criteria for being postmodern vary a good deal. The very term postmodernist draws attention to a mixture of historical period and ideological implications. The claim of any work of art or thinker or social practice to typify postmodernist doctrines or to diagnose with accuracy the social condition of postmodernity will therefore depend on the very diverse criteria that have held sway in the minds of most commentators on the subject, including my own. I nevertheless hope that in what follows I will capture a broad consensual view of postmodernism. I will introduce the most important of the large family of ideas involved, but cannot, in the space available, pay too much attention to the intriguing disputes between them. I concentrate on what seem to me to have the most viable and long-lived postmodernist ideas, and especially those that can help us to characterize and understand the innovative art and cultural practices of the period since the mid-1960s. We should be prepared to see many postmodernist ideas as very interesting and influential, and as the key to some good experimental art, but at best confused, and at worst, simply untrue. This is not unusual. The essential leading ideas of many cultural epochs are open to the same criticism. Once found out, such ideas are either reinterpreted, like the romantic idea of imagination, or just condemned to obsolescence, like the idea of mesmerism in medicine. All extremist intellectual movements in history have this character, and postmodernism is one of them. No one now subscribes entirely to the romantic view of imagination, even though the functions of the imagination have remained an abiding and central concern. And 18th-century mesmerism and 20th-century hypnotism are very different from one another. The rise of radical ideas, as of radical political parties, in the 20th century has generally led to disillusion followed by modification, and this seems already to be the fate of postmodernism from the 1960s to the 1990s. After all, it has already lasted as long as the high modernism of the period before the war, of which it is, for those in favor of it, the politically progressive replacement, and for those against it, the last decadent gasp.